Ms. Jarrett, trustee at all, versus Northern Regional Park Authority, favor the trustee, the fellow council, favor the overall, I'm going to go.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is David Gutkowski, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants in this case, Robert C. McDarmid, Mary S. McDarmid, in their capacities as trustees of the McDarmid Land Trust. If I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
Thank you. We're here today on two assignments of error, both related to a complaint filed by the trustees of the Land Trust pertaining to a piece of property located in Vienna, Virginia. The piece of property abuts the WOD Trail, which is a bicycle trail used in Northern Virginia, and Meadowlark Road, which is a road that runs adjacent to the property that's in question here. There are two counts that we assigned error to. One was a trespass cause of action, and the second one is a cause of action under Virginia Code 801-187 related to a determination that an uncompensated taking had taken place and asking for a commissioner to be appointed to determine just compensation. As a preliminary matter, in our brief, we cite to the standard review that's very familiar to this court related to a motion to strike. At the trial court level, the court struck, there was four counts in our complaint. There was a trespass count, which is count one. There was a inverse condemnation common law claim, which was count two. There was the claim under 801-187, which was count three. And there was a claim under 42 USC 1983, which was count four.
I mean, a deck action is not technically a cause of action. It's just a remedy for a cause of action.
Right. We took advantage of, there's a statutory cause of action. Well, there's a statutory mandate or statutory
right of action
that we undertook. Correct. That we.
It's a right of action. It's a remedy.
Correct. And the way that the statute is written, we petitioned the court to declare that taking had taken place and then ask for the...
Why doesn't that defeat your trespass claim as a matter of law? If the trespass claim is an equitable claim seeking an injunction to keep the, in this case, the government, from being on your property, the adequate remedy of law is an inverse condemnation claim, because the government can take your property if they want to for something that's a public use. And they obviously have. If your theory is right, they've taken your property.
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. One is we're permitted to plead alternate theories.
I get that, but again, specifically, you can't get an equitable remedy if there's an adequate remedy of law, right? So injunction is an equitable remedy for trespass. So if the government's trespassing on your property, you can't get an injunction to kick them off because they can stay there whether you want them there or not if they have... public use or public benefit passes the appropriate test. Therefore, isn't the inverse condemnation claim an adequate remedy of law that actually defeats the injunctive relief for trespass?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and the reason is twofold. One is, because the nature of this trespass is a continuing trespass, I believe the cases cited in both our brief and, frankly, the Appellee's brief stand for the proposition that, and Lavisa Cole in particular, the proposition that when there's a trespass of a continuing nature, that to real property, not to personal property. That's the key distinction.
But those cases, one of which I've worked on, are not involving the government taking property. Well, so there's no adequate remedy of law because you can't sue the trespasser for inverse condemnation.
And the Sheffield case cited to by the appellee specifically states that, and it is admittedly dicta, but specifically states that while in that case, if you're familiar with it, in that case, the court set forth that an action for ejectment, which would be similar to a trespass claim, that an action for ejectment can lie against a governmental entity. In that particular case, this court determined that it shouldn't lie for reasons specific to that case, and in making that ruling, actually specifically, this court set forth that the decision should not be read to foreclose that remedy. against the government.
So if there's no inverse condemnation remedy available and no prima facie remedy available, like there's an episodic trespass or something like that, where they're actually not trying to take property, but here, they, if it's your property and if the burden of proofs have all been met, the whole thesis of this case is they flat out took your property.
The thesis of this case is that they constructed a trail on the appellant's property, on the trustee's property, correct?
So at the end of the case, suppose I'm the trial judge and I say to the government lawyers, all right, I'm enjoining you, pull up the walkway and take it away. And they say, we'll just pay for it if that's the case, but we have a right to be here. We can take it for public use. Why wouldn't I say, okay, well, then pay for it?
I understand the point, Your Honor. I do believe, though, that those cases that allow for an injunction to lie when the trespass is continuing provide for that remedy here.
Other than Mr. Jarrett's testimony, what is there that would create an issue of fact for the fact finder?
There's Ms. McDormand and Mr. McDormand's anecdotal testimony
But they said, they had some sense this may be their property, but then when pinned down...
So I think there's a distinction.
I mean, they acknowledge it's a gray area, we're not really sure. Well, it just seems really thin. I want to make sure I don't overlook anything.
Yes, Your Honor, I appreciate the question and the opportunity to explain a bit further there. So I think Ms. McDormand's testimony is really not, it's unequivocal, frankly. I mean, she testified at trial that she returned to the property, saw, after initially having discussions with the Park Authority about the location of the trail back in 2007, some 7 years later came to the property and witnessed construction activities that were occurring if you're facing it, to the right of this outlet road that existed, and clearly 10 to 13 feet on their property. There was no gray area discussion regarding that portion of it. The gray area discussion related to the outlet road itself and the ownership of that outlet road amongst that piece of property and the neighboring piece of property. And so that's where the gray area discussion occurred, not necessarily her own testimony as to her knowledge as to where the boundary line was, understanding she's not a surveyor, I understand, Your Honor. But where that boundary line was and where those activities took place 10 to 13 feet into their property, and the construction of the trail into their property, the removal of trees on the property, etc.
What is your best evidence that title was proven to the outlet road on which the connector trail was constructed?
So that's an excellent question. The best evidence we would have with that, I suppose, is Mr. Francis' testimony, but I'm not sure that is something that this court is necessarily required to get to in order to reverse and remand this case to the trial court. And the reason is Mr. Jarrett's survey sets forth that the trail, and Mr. Jarrett testified at length at trial as to what he did in order to create the survey. But Mr. Jarrett's survey, and again, we're at the motion to strike phase of this case, but Mr. Jarrett's survey shows the encroachment onto the property owned by the land trust, of the trail and some signage and some fencing. And so where exactly the title to the outlet road in that respect isn't necessarily something I don't think this court needs to determine in order to reverse or remand the case to the trial court.
Why not? I mean, that's the very first thing you have to prove.
I think we need to prove title to the property upon which the trespass occurred. I think Mr. Jarrett's survey does that.
Well, and in a typical case, you know, Med-Mal, you know, tort, whatever, you have your battle of experts, you know,
right.
And so this engineer says the product's defective, the other says it's not, whatever. But here the surveyors, I mean, what we've said in our cases is the criteria is sort of hardened into rules of law. And what the other side pointed out is, but he didn't do it according to that criteria. He sort of, you know, gave priority to the wrong things. And so therefore, you know, his survey is just, as a matter of law, as opposed to just a battle of experts, is just wrong. So how do we hurdle that?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. The survey and what Mr. Jarrett testified to at trial is not that he ignored these other natural or man-made monuments, is that he took these different things into account, that he did walk the property and traverse the property on several occasions, that he did use a Piney Branch, which is a waterway bordering the property, that he did use the old roadbed that divided lot 3 and 4, which was carved out of lot 1 from the 1856 deed. So he didn't just rely upon the third of five factors in creating a survey. He, as I would assume any good surveyor would do, it was the totality of the information available to him, including the deed that Mr. Gogol at trial referenced, which is the Middle Ark subdivision deed. Mr. Jarrett further testified after that cross-examination upon a follow-up question that, you know, even given where that line was drawn, it's still tied into the other items that he was looking at in creating that survey. So I don't think that the survey as a matter of law is defective. I think Mr. Jarrett testified as to what he did to create that survey, and I think the survey shows title to the property vested in the land trust.
Well, how do you deal with Mr. Schranz's testimony?
Well, that's an excellent question. Thank you for that question. On some level, again, I don't think his testimony is really required to be reviewed, and that's why we didn't cite to it in the brief, frankly.
Well, to prove title to property, you have to have a title examination.
Well, we have the deeds in evidence, and we have Mr. Jarrett's survey that discusses his review of the deeds that he used in creating the survey, and the survey shows the property. So we would assert that certainly at the motion strike phase, we've satisfied that burden.
You theoretically, under your best case scenario, you satisfied a prima facie burden for purposes of the motion to strike, but as these questions are digging in a little bit, you're going, your best case scenario, you know, what's the end game?
I understand that, Your Honor. I fully understand that if this court were to reverse remand, the case will be in front of the same judge who made the determination at the end of our case in chief that we don't have a case. I understand the reality of that situation. My work will be cut out for me when Mr. Gogol puts on his case in chief, and I relish that challenge, and it certainly will be a challenge, but that doesn't mean that the court didn't err in granting the motion to strike. And I did want to reserve a bit of time for rebuttal, but the one thing I would also say, and Mr. Gogol can address this, is I didn't touch upon the standard review. I believe in discussing with Mr. Gogol briefly before argument that he would agree with there's competing standard reviews in the brief and the opposition brief, that he would actually agree with our standard review applying to this course in terms.
We have 2 minutes and 11 seconds left.
Thank you very much.
Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia. May it please the Court, my name is David Gogol. I represent the appellee of the Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority. And just by what Mr. Gutkowski was referencing, I do want to make a correction in my brief on the standard review. In the case law that he was citing all had to do with cases where there wasn't discretion. And I thought that perhaps the standard review might be a little different, where DJ action and an injunction are discretionary. The courts have or committed the sound discretion of the court. But I think it's clear that on a motion to strike, the court's not acting as a trier of fact. It's really ruling.
So you're conceding that didn't happen here because it's not infrequent, as trial lawyers know, that you get to the end of a bench trial and the plaintiff's case in chief and the trial judge is saying, I don't need to hear anymore.
Right.
I am going to make a merits determination, and you're not only, I don't care if you're at prima facie or not, I'll never accept preponderance. And the defense stands down if they know anything about what they're doing. And even though the trial judge uses the wrong locution, that's actually what's happening. But you've not made that claim here. I don't want to.
No, I don't make the claim that the judge made a merits decision. Okay. I think what the court decided was there was no evidence that, at the end of their case, based on the testimony, there really was no evidence that the park authority was on their property. You had Mr. Schrantz testify. I mean, first of all, just a couple of housekeeping things. There was no response to reply brief to our argument on the requirement to trace the Commonwealth. And I think that is a point that I would like to just reiterate, that just like ejectment cases, a case for continuing trespass where you're not in possession, and remember, this area of the property is a gated area that was used as a driveway for the Beckwiths. They're arguing that that the trail that was put on that path belongs to them. And I think it was incumbent upon them to trace their time with the Commonwealth. And we cited the Kraft case and the Edwards case. And they put a few deeds in, but they didn't do that. So it's. I just want to make sure I mention that. They also conceded to the court they had to prove clear title. They make the prima facie case. They had to prove clear title. And there are a couple cases, the Benoit case and the Callaway case, that reference that it's well settled and an applicant possession of land with clear title or prima facie title is entitled injunction. And the court understood from counsel that was the requirement to make a prima facie case. But, you know, also the key thing here is that the burden was on the trustees to prove, to identify and locate the land which they claimed and to show that the same embraced within their designated boundaries. So they had to prove that where we put our trail was on their property. And that's what they didn't do. The first expert, Mr. Schrantz, said, in essence, he said, based on his review of the land records and the fact that this was, it was not a physical road. In 1908, it was described by beats and bounds. So that's the confusion with Mr. McDermott testifying about where the Beppis driveway was, as if that was the outlet road. No, in 1908, it was described by beats and bounds. And Mr. Schrantz said, based on that description, nobody could locate that line. So in essence, he said, you know, the plaintiffs can't prove their case. The trustees can't prove where the line is between lot one and the outlet. Then Ms. McDermott takes the stand, and she makes references to, well, first of all, she says, what the Park Authority did is they took the Beckwith driveway and they moved it over and put the trail where the driveway is. So it seemed like she was saying, you know, what she thought was the outlet road is where we put the connector trail. But it seems like because of Mr. Jarrett's survey, or I'm not sure why, she starts referencing that we're so many feet away from the outlet road. Well, Mr. Schrantz testified, first of all, that is it's a 1908 legal description. It's not a physical monument. So she couldn't testify. In other words, the judge ruled that all she could do would be guessing where that road was or where the outlet was because it's actually a matter of a legal description. So the court gave no weight to her testimony about where the outlet was because she couldn't know where it was. And Mr. Schrantz, as the title examiner expert, said nobody could do that. And then you had Mr. Jarrett take the stand. And Mr. Jarrett, as Justice McClanahan had noted, he testified what those preferences were. And, of course, the first preference was the natural monuments. And I pointed out that the important corner, the difficult run, which was the line that ran to the outlet, he's off. He's not even in the middle of it. He doesn't even touch difficult run. He's supposed to be in the middle of it. And then it kind of explains what the error he made was. He was trying to find the outlet, and he testifies in his trial that there are no monuments for that. There are no monuments. So what he does is he finds the Meadow Larch subdivision over here, and he finds some pipes. And he makes the assumption that the 15-foot outlet must adjoin that subdivision. So when we talk about that third preference, which is lines of an adjoining property, the Meadow Larch subdivision is not even an adjoining property. He makes the assumption that it's 15 feet, that the outlet adjoins it. A trial actually showed him that subdivision, 1976 subdivision, and confronted him with the fact that there's no reference to a 15-foot outlet. And that subdivision actually adjoins a 30-foot right-of-way. And he testified that he had no idea what that right-of-way was. And that's why the judge concluded he was just speculating. But to be honest, it's that rare case where you actually have an expert who makes a mistake, and in making that mistake, he almost proves your case. He basically proves your case because he earlier testified that the Metal Arc Road was coming down, the center line of that road, it divided between the old Lot 3 and Lot 4. And the outlet was on Lot 4. And the orthogonal portions on Lot 3. And so I asked him, I said, do you know what the right-of-way is? He said, I don't know. I said, except if I guess, if you carried that Metal Arc Road down, the center line of that right-of-way would be the center line between Lots 3 and Lot 4. Well, if that's the case, he put the 15-foot outlet on the orthogonal portion when it should have been on the Martha Gunnel division. That's why I explained in our brief that old division of where the roads were. So in essence, what he did is he missed it by 15 feet.
At the conclusion of your questioning of him on redirect, he has asked a question along the lines of, has anything that you've been asked on cross changed your opinion as to whether this is an encroachment on their property? And he says no. So even though you had a fairly effective cross-examination, didn't the trial court err when it weighed the credibility of the evidence at the motion to strike stage?
No, Your Honor, that's not the case. If you look at what...
Which is not the case.
Well, that he didn't concede the error. And I point you to a couple places in his testimony. First of all, the Joint Appendix, page 322. And this is when I confronted him with the center line. In fact, the center line is between lots 3 and 4.
I think 332, where he seems to be asked on redirect. And it's a convoluted response that he gives. But he seems to be asked if anything that you ask him on cross-examination would change his opinion. And he goes, wouldn't throw anything over there and wouldn't, I'm trying to interpret what he's saying. I'm thinking he's saying it doesn't change my opinion. I could be wrong.
Well, I'm not saying he didn't say that, Your Honor.
Okay.
What I'm saying is the trial court judge had to decide whether or not this expert was guessing or speculating, and whether or not what he provided was evidence that the court could even consider, whether it was
Wouldn't it be the equivalent of a lawyer and a judge calling out an expert on a math error?
Right.
You know, you say the widget should withstand X amount of pressure. Well, here's the equation you use. Well, here's the variables that are wrong, and so he came out with a wrong number, and then, well, he can stand on his opinion all he wants, but if it's just factually wrong, then it's game over.
That's exactly it. I think that's, in the transcript I asked him about the center line, he said the center line was, this is on page 322 of the Joint Appendix, the center line was supposed to be the property line, and at the time that the subdivision was created, it was the property line. And I said, but when the subdivision occurred in 1976, this subdivision, which is the one in the Canyon subdivision, and that's Exhibit 43, our defendant's Exhibit 43, they went ahead and drew Parcel C as not including the right-of-way. And he says, okay. I said, right? I've seen surveyors make that mistake. And I said, okay, well, but the problem is you relied on that boundary line to draw the 15 feet. In other words, he used these pipes, assuming it was adjoining a 15-foot outlet, and then he said, that surveyor should have drawn it at the center line. And I said, but you relied on it, even though it wasn't drawn that way. So everything should have been moved 15 feet. And if you move things to 15 feet, then we're exactly where we believe we are. We're right on the outlet where we constructed the connector trail. So, but the court decided was, based on his testimony, he had made a mistake. He relied on something. He made an assumption it wasn't true, that his testimony wasn't reliable. It was not. It was based on speculation and guessing. He was guessing what he didn't know what the right of way was. He was guessing about everything that had to do with his decision to use those pipes.
Now, your opposing counsel says, well, there's this hierarchy of values you're supposed to employ, and he didn't employ those, but he took all those variables into account. And so, you know, the monuments and so on and so forth. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is that he testified that the first preference was the natural monuments, and he completely disregarded the difficult run. And that explains why he misses it, because he is pushing things over 15 feet. So I don't think he could say truthfully that he followed the order of preferences that is a rule of law in terms of doing the survey work. And so, but at a minimum, this court, after hearing his testimony, concluded that he was, by his own words, in his transcript, he talks about guessing what the right-of-way was. So he made an assumption that turned out not to be true by his own admission.
Does that approach impact the standard of review? Because
I think it does, Your Honor, because it's not like he's judging his credibility. He's just saying
your opinion is inadmissible technically. Because
if you're speculating, guessing, then it's not admissible. It's not evidence.
That's generally speaking an abuse of discretion standard from an expert opinion.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
So we really have two layers of standard review. The first is what factoids go into the mix, and on the expert factoid, there's some play in the joints. And then after all those factoids put together, could a rational person, if they wanted to, conclude that there is a persuasive preponderance on this issue?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The first threshold is deciding whether this evidence is really admissible, whether it's even...
But really, everything turns on Jarrett in this case. I mean, we've talked about it as a complex problem, but really, if Jarrett's opinion is just, I'm not going to hear that, it's obviously speculative, and I'll say motion to strike the evidence, I'll say motion to strike the expert, whatever, it doesn't matter, I'm just not going to do that. I just don't put any weight. It's not that it's incredible, I'm not going to hear it. There's nothing left.
Right. And I think that's exactly what he says in the record when he rules on the motion to strike. He says, I found that, you know, basically, McDermott's are guessing. Mr. Schrantz said you can't find it. And McDermott's are guessing when they're trying to say it's a physical monument, but it's not. And then Mr. Jarrett is speculating because he thought he was using a boundary that was adjoining a 15-foot outlet, and it turns out he was using something that was adjoining a 30-foot right-of-way. And when I asked him, confronted him about the 30 feet, he said, well, I don't know, it could be 25 feet on the other side. Might be a 30, it might be a, you know, a 45 feet, you know, area. So he was actually creating more confusion about, you know, this plat that he relied on.
But do you get to any of these questions if you believe that the first proposition that you gave us, which is that prima facie title isn't proven?
I don't think you get. Yeah, I think if you didn't prove title to Commonwealth, trace your title to Commonwealth or common grantor, you don't
even
get past first base.
Right.
But I also think here he acknowledged that clear title was required, and they didn't put on a prima facie case of title to this property that we were
right.
on. And then on top of that, I agree with Justice Kelsey on the Sheffield case. You know, it's pretty clear that there's no point if the government is off a little bit or whatever. You know, the remedy is inverse condemnation. It's not to force the government to move it. And that's the Sheffield case. It says, the public is benefiting from a particular use of property. Ejecting would cause that use to discontinue with possible harm to the public. Although such relief is sometimes granted, it is more often denied, usually because of the possible harmful effect upon the public welfare. And this is a trail being used daily by the public. Some people use it for commuting to work. So the idea that the court would stop that when we would just turn around and condemn it if we're wrong, the judicial economy, everything is it makes sense that you would not, you know, have an injunction. And the other thing, I didn't get to it, but I did want to say on count two that I do think that the law of the case moots that count completely. They had a full hearing on inverse condemnation, but the idea that they could use a DJ to get a second bite at the apple, I think that would violate the
law. You're talking about count three, which is the second assignment of error.
I'm sorry?
Count three, not count two.
Count three. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's it. Count three.
I just want to make sure.
Your time has expired.
Thank you. Thank you.
Before you get up for rebuttal, I'd like to offer a helpful suggestion to both of you. The court actually encourages using demonstrative exhibits here, and that actually helps rather than have people point to the sky and to the left and to the right.
I agree.
And we actually encourage it. So don't hesitate to ask. All right?
Appreciate that. I did put the plats, some of them in my brief, so hopefully that was helpful.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. wanted to touch upon a couple of things that Mr. Gould raised in his arguments. As far as the notion that the court struck the evidence, or struck rather the opinion of Mr. Jarrett, I don't think that's what the trial court did, and I don't think that's what the record reflects. The survey was admitted into evidence. His testimony was admitted into evidence without objection. Mr. Gould did raise objections to Mr. France's expert testimony, but didn't raise any such objections to Mr. Jarrett's expert testimony. So the notion that the trial court struck Mr. Jarrett as an expert witness, I don't think is supported by the record.
Can I challenge you a little bit on that? The court struck the evidence. The expert's testimony is part of the evidence. And it's not unusual at all for a trial judge to let something in and then later conclude, I'm giving it no weight, I probably shouldn't have let it in to begin with.
I understand that. I just wanted to point out, I understand that.
But you're technically right. There wasn't a motion to throw the expert off the stand after Cross.
And that was the point I was raising. And I don't think the record of the, I don't think the record reflects that that's actually what the trial court did in any
then,
of that.
Then help me understand this. If Jarrett is the only way you get over the prima facie hurdle, and an abuse of discretion standard governs a trial court's decision to accept an opinion from an expert, because we're dealing with opinion evidence now, not fact evidence. The abuse of discretion governs accepting an opinion or not accepting it because of its speculative inadequate fact background. Why couldn't that produce two different standards of review not in your favor, because the only thing you've got is now essentially kicked out on a highly deferential appellate review point?
I am unaware, although I'm unaware of a lot of things, but I'm unaware of a case that stands for the proposition that on a motion to strike that anything other than the standard review that I'm asking this court to apply would apply. And so that case may exist, but I'm not aware of it if it does. And I see my time is up. I apologize. I didn't get to a couple other points. Do you have any other questions? If not, I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call the next case.